day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Morris Worldwide Value Fund Investor Call. All lines have been placed on a listen-only mode. If you should require assistance throughout the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad to reach a live operator. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Mary Papamarkou. Ma'am, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kat. Good afternoon. My name is Mary Papamarkou. Welcome to the Morris Worldwide Value Fund Investor Call. Joining me today are Amit Wadhwani, Portfolio Manager and Co-founder of Morris Capital Management, as well as John Morrow and Michael Campagna, Research Analysts and Co-founders. Before we get started, there are a few disclosures I would like to review. As a reminder, this call is intended exclusively for investment professionals. Any members of the general public, the press, or non-professional investors should hang up at this time. Any investments mentioned on this call are for illustrative and discussion purposes only, and there is no assurance that Morris Capital Management will make any investments with the same or similar characteristics as any investments presented. There is no guarantee that any investment will achieve its objectives, generate positive returns, or avoid losses. Investors should carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses before investing. This and other important information about the fund is contained in the prospectus, which can be obtained by calling 1-844-MORRIS-1 or by visiting www.morriscap.com. The prospectus should be read carefully before investing. The Morris Worldwide Value Fund is distributed by Foreside Fund Services, LLC. And now I'd like to turn the call over to Amit.
Thank you, Mary. Good afternoon, everybody, for joining us today on the investor call of Morris Worldwide Value Fund. Today, my comments will reference both mutual fund classes, which I will collectively refer to in my comments as the fund or simply MOICs. Now, let's review the fund's performance and the contributors and detractors to this performance. As a note, in my comments about the fund's performance, I will reference two indices, MSCI All Country World Index and MSCI All Country World Index ex-US. Given the fund's focus on international, that is, non-US securities, the more meaningful performance comparison is with the latter index, MSCI ACWI ex-US. Okay, first, the performance. Year-to-date, through the end of April 2024, MOICs returned 7.08%, while the MSCI All Country World Index is up 4.63%, and MSCI ACWI ex-US returned 2.81%. For the 12 months ended April, the fund was up 29.66%, the MSCI All Country World Index returned 17.46%, and MSCI ACWI ex-US returned 9.33%. Turning to the longer-term performance, which is of greater interest to us given our more extended time horizons, for the 3 years ended April, the fund compounded at a rate of 14.37%. MSCI ACWI returned 4.27%, and MSCI ACWI ex-US returned 0.35%. And finally, for 5 years and the April 2024, the fund was up 9.67% compounded, while MSCI ACWI returned 9.44% and MSCI ACWI ex-US returned 5.03%. Looking behind this performance, we see the following notable contributors and detractors during this period. In the year-to-date period through the end of April 2024, the best largest contributor was Grupo Financiero Galicia, which was up 87.8% through the end of April. Grupo Financiero Galicia is one of the larger domestic banks in Argentina, a country that appears to be in the early stages of an economic transition under a new governor with significantly different policies than its predecessor. The policies are showing underlying tentative signs of progress. Inflation has fallen progressively. The government has had its first surplus in decades. So lower inflation accompanied by economic stability could result in increased investment and spending by businesses and consumers alike, both of whom have been sitting on their hands and which are among the least leveraged in Latin America, given the tremendous period of uncertainty that they've gone through with the previous government. These shares were acquired late 2023 at a very, very modest multiple of earnings, let's say low single digits, and well below book value. Further enhancing Galicia's prospects is its proposed acquisition of HSBC's Argentinian banking business at less than half of book value and yet again a very low multiple of earnings, which would raise its market share to 13.5% while vaulting it to the position of being the largest private sector bank in the market. And of course, this will increase its exposure to economic upswing if and when it comes, were it to happen, if these policies actually get traction. The second largest contributor was Despegar.com, which we've spoken about before. This was up 28.8% during this period. Despegar is the largest online travel agent in Latin America. We bought these shares during the pandemic when travel had largely shut down across the region, the one exception being Mexico. The operating results had already begun to comfortably exceed 2019 financial results, in part because of the sharp cost reductions implemented during the pandemic. With improving sales lead to succession of positive earnings surprises, the stock has, of course, appreciated on the back of that. The third largest contributor was Turkish Sigorta, a company that I've spoken about before. It was up 48.9% through April 2024. As the name might suggest, it's an insurance company in Turkey. Better pricing of its policies led to improved underwriting performance, along with higher interest rates, augmenting the investment earnings of the insurer's portfolio. And this, of course, led the swing back to its profitability. Dundee Corp was the fourth largest contributor. It was up 42.87%, through the end of April. Dundee is in a period of transition from being a holding company with a diverse collection of assets and businesses to one that is building a portfolio which is somewhat narrowly focused on investments in and providing financing to smaller mining companies, precious and base metals. There was a bid for one of its larger holdings in mid-April, which in turn, of course, has led to recognition of value embedded in these shares and, of course, to the sharp appreciation that took place in the last month. The next largest contributor, which I've spoken about before a few times, was Tidewater. This provider of boats to offshore oil and gas producers was up 27.4% during the period. Higher oil prices certainly work to benefit Tidewater, but more importantly, it has done better because of the rapidly improving business conditions for its service. Given that several of its competitors have folded and many of the remainder are on the ropes, and in such financial conditions that oil majors will be reluctant to have them as a counterparty. In addition, helped by various well-priced acquisitions it has made over the last few years, it has significantly expanded its footprint around the world in many key markets. Turning now to the detractors. The worst performer was Companhia Brasileira de Distribuição, or CBD for short, was down 32.4% through the end of April. The decline in these shares reflected a negative market view of the potentially dilutive impact of an equity issuance by the company to bolster its balance sheet. Our view is that, in the net, despite the short-term decline in the stock price, this equity resulted in, it will allow the company to make the necessary investments to maintain and improve its competitiveness over the longer run, which is really what matters to us primarily. Douglas Elliman Inc., a U.S.-listed company, was the second-largest detractor for performance during this period, declining 29.2%. Douglas Elliman is a residential brokerage company which has predictably been buffeted by a variety of factors such as higher interest rates, the slowdown in residential turnover in its historical markets, greater New York City area, San Francisco, and so forth. We will return to it in more detail later in this call when outlining the new purchases during this period. The next largest decliner were the shares of Straits Trading Company Limited, a Singapore-listed holding company with real estate-centric focus across a variety of economies, Korea, China, Singapore, Australia, and the UK. Straits' shares were down 21.4% during the period. Like most real estate companies, it was affected by higher interest rates and their impact on the carrying value of its holdings. The fourth largest decliner were shares of John Wood Group PLC, the London-listed engineering consulting company focused on energy-related projects, both the traditional and renewable varieties. It was down 50.28%. The stock price declined following the fiscal year 23 earnings release because the company indicated positive free cash flow would only be reached in 2025, rather than 2024, as was previously expected. The reason for this delay in attaining positive free cash flow was a cost-cutting plan that would result in an outlay of $70 million during 2024, but which would result in an annual recurrent savings of $60 million thereafter. Rounding out the list of the top five detractors to performance were the shares of Arcos Dorado Holdings, which declined 14.58%. These shares have performed very well since the onset of the pandemic, as their operations rebounded very rapidly due to online and drive-through purchases by the network of freestanding sales outlets. That operating performance continued until earlier this year, and the shares continue to be very modestly valued in absolute terms, and even more so to its comparables in the US, Japan, and especially in India. Aside from recounting the individual contributors and detractors, during the last call, I noted a few overarching features that influence performance and might well do so in future periods. Let me quickly touch upon these. First, there's been an all-consuming obsession with interest rates, whether the forecast of interest rates as well as their path. And these change with every release of any economic data point. This is hardly of any interest to us as a long-term investor. And since economic variables are for us difficult, if not well-nigh impossible for us to forecast repeatedly and accurately, and could very well change from one forecast to the next, possibly a lot during a holding period, we do not engage in very much of such forecasting. Rather, we focus on assessing the survivability of the investment company under possible adverse economic scenarios. So armed with a level of comfort these stress tests provide, we can turn a blind eye to the distractions of macro variables moving around. That is not to say that the market value of our holdings is unaffected in the short term. It is certainly affected by prevailing views of the state of the economy and whether interest rates are expected to move up or down. This goes some way to explain the fund's performance in the first 2 months of this year, where there was a flight to large cap tech stocks such as Magnificent Seven. Then, of course, this reversed in March and April when interest rate expectations changed yet again, and the Fed indicated there will be interest rate cuts, but not just yet. Now, the second lingering risk that could upend markets and our stock holdings is that an escalation of any of the conflicts currently underway, the Russia-Ukraine war or the one in the Middle East, or the start of yet another as yet unknown conflict. The exact impacts of these on the world at large or our portfolio constitute imponderables, depending on the locus and shape of the specific conflict, but this is one of the potential black swan type events lurking in the background. Turning now to portfolio activity. First, in sales. We sold the shares of Nuvama Wealth Management, which we spoke about during the last call. You may recall we received these shares when they were spun off from Edelweiss Financial Services, one of our existing holdings. While Nuvama is a fine company, its attractions have not gone unnoticed by investors. And it's garnered, of course, a clutch of buy recommendations and an arguably high valuation, even by the context of generally highly valued Indian equity, by the highly valued Indian equity market. There were a few notable purchases. MEG Energy, a Canadian oil producer with long-lived proven reserves measured in decades, and the nature of which necessitates limited recurrent capital investment, the upshot of which it generates considerably unencumbered cash flow, which of course makes it highly attractive. But there have been two flies in the ointment. One, the egress capacity of Canadian oil to the U.S. and off the offshore markets has been limited by pipeline capacity, which has required the Canadian product to be sold at significant discount to, say, an international benchmark, such as Brent. The startup of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is imminent, should bring some relief on this count, with a so-called WCS discount expected to shrink as the transportation capacity becomes available and utilized. The second issue with this company has been its leveraged balance sheet, which Meg possessed a few years ago. This has been dealt with by dedicating the bulk of its free cash to deleveraging. The years of deleveraging are expected to come to an end in Q3 2024, when MEG gets to its comfortable target level of net debt of $600 million, after attaining which the excess cash flow will be returned to shareholders either via dividend or share purchases or possibly a combination of the two. What conventional analysts seem to have glossed over is the long-lived nature of these assets, the limited reinvestment requirement, which would allow a long-lived stream of shareholder returns from this excess cash flow. To discuss the next purchase, Douglas Elliman, which I alluded to earlier on the call, let me turn to Michael.
Thanks, Amit. In February, we started purchasing shares of a company called Douglas Elliman, which, as Amit noted, is a residential real estate broker. Given the dynamics of the industry, it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that this business has been suffering from a macroeconomic perspective. Douglas Elliman is the fifth largest residential broker nationally, and it has a market-leading position in some interesting high-end markets, including New York City, Miami, the Hamptons, Boston, California, Texas, specifically Dallas, Fort Worth area, and a little bit in Colorado. As I noted, the business has faced a substantial slowdown in residential transaction volumes as mortgage rates have gone from sub 3% nationally to over 7% nationally. What's happened is there's been a significant decrease in the amount of homes, of existing homes that have been put up for sale. So inventory is at all-time lows, and transactions are at multi-year lows. The in 2023, there were 4.1 million existing home sales. That was the lowest level since 1995, and well below the 15-year average of more than 5 million homes sold per year. But you know, cyclically depressed industry is not enough to get us excited. Doug is interesting for a few other reasons. On top of being a cyclically depressed business right now, you know, I mentioned their market-leading market share position in some higher-end markets. The average sales price of a Douglas Elliman home that was either sold or bought with one of their agents was $1.59 million in 2023, which is 50% higher than its closest competitor, which is Compass, which is another high-end brokerage, and a multiple of the kind of the broader scale residential brokerages that are listed in the United States. It's a smaller cap company with an odd shareholder base. Douglas Elliman was spun out of a tobacco company just over 2 years ago, and most of its shareholders are still the tobacco company shareholders. Because of its smaller market cap and quirky shareholder base, it's, you know, in our opinion, it's not very well followed or very well covered. And you know, while the business is generating losses now, just given the economic headwinds that I mentioned earlier, it's important to look at the financial position, and the company has a net cash balance sheet of more than $125 million, which is a vestige of their spinoff. They were spun off with more than $200 million of cash 2 years ago, really to grow the business. But given what's gone on in their markets, now that cash balance is really a nice ballast for the business. The second interesting thing is from a valuation perspective, that cash balance equates to about $1.39 per share. Douglas Elliman closed today at $1.40 per share. So effectively, you're paying 1 cent per share for the core residential brokerage business. I think it's quite interesting because that cash balance, as I noted earlier, was really for growth. It's not cash that needs to be spent. Putting that a different way, if you adjust for the cash balance, you're effectively buying the entire Douglas Elliman business for less than $5 million today at today's stock price. And this is a business that generated about $1 billion in revenue last year and could easily go on to do that again this year. So while it's a challenging market and likely to remain challenging, we feel confident that given the deep discount and the strong financial position that Douglas Elliman has, not only will it be able to survive the current downturn, but they'll actually be able to benefit from it and take advantage by hiring new agents and taking some market share. So that's one of the fund's newer investments and typical of Morris's investment philosophy. And a firm in an industry that is undergoing a challenging, not even near-term, but mid-term outlook, but very well positioned from a balance sheet perspective and survivability is high in our opinion. Back to you, Amit.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks. Let me turn to something else. I mean, one of the areas I mentioned the last time that has generated returns to us has been corporate activity in various of our names. This could take various forms: acquisitions, divestitures, returns of capital, and raising of monies, and so forth. Which obviously the benefits inure to us, the shareholders. Let me just highlight just a couple of these things that have recently been taking place. One I mentioned earlier was the Grupo Financiero Galicia buying HSBC's business for what looked like 2.5 times earnings, if that, and about 40 cents on book value dollar. I mean, this, of course, as I said, will really benefit the company because it increases the footprint of Galicia as we enter, if, as, and when there is a genuine economic recovery actually does take hold in Argentina. Another item I should mention is, of course, the fundraising by CBD and, of course, the sale of assets, namely real estate, head office real estate, to improve its balance sheet, to reinvest in its business. But that's really a bit more business as usual, but just supplemental business as usual. Another one situation that I should allude to, which is not strictly speaking in the period through the end of April, one of our holdings, Westaim, announced, which is a holding financial holding company, which owns both an insurance company, Skywood Insurance, as well as holdings in an asset manager, Arena, is selling a slug of its shares in Skybird, and of course, these proceeds will be redeployed in buying back. I mean, there is a vast disparity between Skybird's valuation, which trades at a multiple of book value, a meaningful multiple of book, whereas the owners, namely Westaim's shares, are relatively speaking quite undervalued. Many of our companies continue with the stock repurchase programs, be it Exor, be it International Petroleum Company. Jefferies renewed its authorization to buy back another quarter of $1 billion worth of shares. Standard and Chartered, Tidewater has continued buying back shares, as is UniCredit. So Spectrum Brands, of course, engaged in a sale of assets, and of course is gradually opportunistically repurchasing shares. I wanted to touch on another subject, somewhat a broader subject, hopefully to, I don't want to use the word demystify because in my mind there's no mystery but of what I'm going to talk about, but rather hopefully give you a window into our thinking. And the topic in question is emerging markets. Okay, so we are often asked about what we think about emerging markets and in particular if you consider ourselves to be an emerging markets fund. Because the latter question is much easier for me to answer, let me answer it first. We are categorically not an emerging markets fund, as manifest by the meaningful developed markets exposure that we have. We are an international fund that is primarily non-US, and we may opportunistically invest in emerging markets. Emerging markets are an international investment hunting ground for growth stocks. There's usually some kind of a growth story surrounding most emerging market securities, be it youthful demographics, be it productivity improvements, income growth, and so forth. It's a collection of growth securities with valuations which are appropriate to growth investors, which are attractive to them, but obviously which are anathema to our style of investing. Our asset-based yardsticks can make it very difficult for us to find emerging market securities that meet that criteria. However, it has been my experience over a few decades, almost three, of investing in such securities, that if you can find such securities, attractive businesses, at an attractive valuation with financial strength in emerging markets, it is worth considering them as potential investing companies, because buying these securities at such severely depressed valuations can be very, very rewarding. That said, and this is the big, big caveat, such opportunities occur very infrequently, and they should be seized if they were to occur. Now, what this means is that there can be long periods when emerging market opportunities are scarce, and you will encounter very, very few of these. We will encounter a few of these, and you will encounter very few of these in our portfolio. What you see in our portfolio currently is the byproduct of particular circumstances that led to these opportunities. For example, one of the original ones was the Lava Jato scandal in Brazil and its attendant political turmoil and the accompanying economic downturn, which gave us our first collection of Brazilian opportunities in the early days of the fund. Sometimes you have extreme macro circumstances, extenuating ones at that. For example, in the recent past, you've seen this in Turkey and in Argentina, which led to individual specific investment opportunities which would not have been cheap otherwise. Or third, you have company-specific sort of missteps that yielded opportunities, for example, Natura in Brazil. Or fourth, the pandemic, which was a much more sort of widespread sort of phenomenon, which yielded attractive investment opportunities in otherwise very hard to invest in markets such as India, which is perpetually expensive, or the travel-ready security that we were able to buy in Latin America when everything shut down there. So there has been, in some sense, a period of plenty in terms of opportunities in emerging markets, no doubt. There will, however, be quieter, leaner periods when you will see fewer emerging market securities in our portfolio and will look more like a developed market securities portfolio. So coming back to our first question, what do we think about emerging markets generally? It's hard to say. I mean, it's really a heterogeneous universe of countries and securities. And so they contain a wide variety of securities, and generalizations are probably hazardous. As bottom-up investors, we tend to avoid making or investing based upon top-down generalizations. There are attractive and less attractive securities scattered across a wide variety of these markets, notwithstanding widely held opinions or headlines. So, I mean, it's really hard to say this is a good place or a bad place. It really is a function of individual securities and opportunities. So let me turn it back to Mary.
So I think a question that may generate from both your discussion and Michael's discussion is, how do you source the ideas that become names that are interesting for the portfolio? For example, how do you see Douglas Elliman where others have not?
Well, Michael, do you want to take Douglas Elliman?
Sure. Just using Douglas Elliman as an example, and putting it in context of the broader idea sourcing, we tend to look for areas that are very out of favor. So in the case of Douglas Elliman, with rising interest rates, you know, you've seen real estate owners get hit hard. You've seen this big wall of worry on the commercial side of debts that are coming due that are going to need to be refinanced. And then on the residential side, you've also seen, as a result of rising mortgage rates, decline in residential transactions. So, you know, that's a starting point for looking. It's not, you know, just because something is cyclically out of favor and cheap does not mean it's an interesting investment. But it is a starting point for us to look and say what is being negatively impacted by this, what we think is a, you know, semi-permanent or transient or whatever we want to call it, trend and creating opportunities for a long-term investor. So in the case of Douglas Elliman specifically, you know, knowing that the company's strong cash position is really going to allow them to weather several years of muted transactions, which is not what is expected right now, but, you know, could come around. And the fact that, you know, the small cap and quirky nature of it has resulted in, we think, a very substantial misvaluation. That's kind of what creates the opportunity there.
So let me step back for a moment. I think Douglas Elliman is a great example. So if you want to get your mind around the sources of opportunity, let me sort of divide them up into a few categories. So one, you have a company that has, because of its individual circumstances, either slips in a banana peel or something happens to the world around it. So the company is a very specific company-specific opportunity, as I mentioned Natura earlier. Or for example, you have a situation, and again, Dr. Selman straddles this category, in that there's something going wrong with the industry or in a given geography, and of course, that precipitates opportunities. Again, what is important is the company. The company should have characteristics of being A, cheap. It should have the characteristic of being very well financed, therefore a survivor. Obviously, it should have been an attractive business. I mean, that is a starting point of any of these things, these exercises, that the business is attractive, we want to own it, and it presents itself as a cheap thing. Now, there are other circumstances that could provide this thing. You could have larger scale events that precipitate these things, a pandemic, for example, or, for example, a capital markets crisis, like you had the Asian crisis in 1998, you had the Eurozone crisis periodically a couple of times over the last decade. And so there are specific opportunities that happen, or the global financial crisis. So opportunities appear to us as a byproduct of these situations.
And it's safe to say they are not formulaic.
No, they're very much one-off. I mean, so this is a sort of, I don't want to call it a hunt and peck discipline, but it is bottom-up. You look at companies one by one. There is a certain degree of business analysis that goes on to sift through and sort through these things. And I suppose one of the things that this plays into is a long history of doing this. I've been sort of at this for a better part of almost 30 years, and Michael and John for a couple of decades. So we have gone through a lot of companies over the years. So we do have some sense of where probably we may look for opportunities should there be some kind of dislocation, should there be some kind of mishap or something difficult happen.
Great. We have time for one more question. We didn't touch on it, and we don't really have any direct exposure, but can you talk about your perspective potentially on China and opportunities there? Everyone wants to talk about China.
Oh. Well, sure. I mean, China may well be a source of opportunities. I'm not so sure I'm trying to lead anybody onto making any inferences of any sort, but China has gotten as cheap as it has been in many years. That is a broad overarching statement. That per se does not give us individual opportunities, you know, jumping out of it. That said, we have a few opportunities in the portfolio which are China exposed in a meaningful fashion. One, we own a company called Sinoland, which is the owner of real estate in both China, mainland China, and Hong Kong. This, again, real estate has been wildly out of fashion, wildly out of favor in China, given, of course, the excess that has gone on there, and, of course, the troubles that you see of a number of the Chinese domiciled real estate developers. Sinoland is as different as night and day from the Chinese, mainland Chinese developers, which are, by and large, quite leveraged, financially leveraged. Sinoland has no net debt. It has a balance sheet that is swimming in net cash. In fact, it more than 50% of its equity market capitalization is accounted for by its net cash balance. The controlling family theoretically could take it private at these market prices using the cash on their own balance sheet. Again, it's cheap. And if should Chinese real estate or Hong Kong real estate come back, we should do quite well with this stuff. Another company that we own, which has a meaningful Greater China exposure, is Standard Chartered Bank PLC. Remember, one of the phenomena about China is there is a fair amount of, I suppose, for lack of a better mince word, capital flight. The Chinese like to put their money outside China as well. So they can take some money out of China and take it to Hong Kong. And there's a really large business in opening bank accounts for mainland Chinese in Hong Kong. And Standard Chartered has been doing very, very well. Standard Chartered is also making headway in terms of opening its own capital markets business in mainland China. So this is going to be a meaningful player in China. Straits Trading, another one that I mentioned earlier as one of the big decliners. During the pandemic, they bought two shopping centers in China. I mean, it has real estate exposure in many countries, be it Korea, China, Singapore, Australia, and the UK, but China has a small amount in China. But no, you're right, Mary. We do not have any securities holdings specifically uniquely domiciled in China at the present time.
And that is our last question. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today. Please reach out for additional information regarding the strategy or the firm. We thank you for your time, and I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, everybody. Look forward to speaking to you all the next quarterly or the next of these calls. Thank you.
We'll go ahead and turn it back over to Kat.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time and have a wonderful day.